York.
Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. And this is the second movement of Bach's Brandenburg Concerto No. 3, performed as Johann Sebastian Bach never, ever could have imagined it. This is Switched On Bach, performed entirely on the Moog synthesizer, an instrument that wasn't even invented until 1965. This very recording of Bach sold more than a million copies. In 1968, it put the Moog electronic synthesizer on the musical map, and the rest became history. The Beatles discovered the Moog, so did the Rolling Stones, the Doors, Emerson, Lake and Palmer. To this day, hip musicians from Radiohead to Tortoise perform on descendants of those original bulky machines made of wires and knobs. Connection listeners, are you an aficionado of the Moog? Do you agree with one learned academic who said that the two most influential instruments created in the 20th century are the electric guitar and the Moog synthesizer? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. You can join us online at theconnection.org. And there really is a Moog behind the Moog synthesizer. He's Robert Moog, Bob Moog. He joins me in the studio today. Welcome to the program.
Glad to be here, Dick.
Now, my deep research into your past tells me that you were playing a lot of classical piano as a kid. Your mom wanted you to be a concert pianist. Your dad, at the same time, allowed you to indulge your interest in electronics at the same time.
Yeah, he was one of the very first radio amateurs. His electronic activities go back to when vacuum tubes were something new and cost $5 a piece. So what he knew about building radios out of vacuum tubes, he taught to me, and I took it from there.
But there was an instrument that came between that sort of youthful confluence of electronics and piano and the synthesizer, and it's one called the theremin.
Yeah. The theremin is an electronic musical instrument that you play without touching it. You move your hands in the space around the instrument. It's named after Leon Theremin, who invented it in 1919 or 1920 in Russia. He was a Russian physicist with classical training in cello.
We know the sound, don't we? I mean, we know it from outer space. Can you? You've got a theremin in the studio with us now. I know you have to step back a little bit away from the microphone to play it, but I'll do a short description of what you're doing as you do that for us, if you will.
Yeah, the theremin has two antennas, a vertical rod on the right, a horizontal rod on the left. When I move my hand near the vertical rod on the right, you'll hear the pitch of a tone go up.
Just get that set here.
Okay, well, we should hear something.
And all Bob's doing is moving his right hand closer and then further away from that vertical antenna. And interfering with an electromagnetic field, is that it?
That's right, yeah. There's an electromagnetic field around the antenna here, and the closer I get my hand to it, the
every
more,
time you gesture, I hear
it. Yeah. Yeah, that's... So if I move my hands precisely and rapidly enough, I can play musical tones. For this, I have to stand up. And when I shake my hand back and forth, I can produce a vibrato. And I'm controlling the loudness of the sound with my left hand, bringing my left hand nearer to and farther away from the volume antenna.
So you're a 19-year-old kid. You decide that you're going to build these things, and 1 year, what, you crank out some 1,000 theremin kits for $49.95 a piece. Is that right?
Well, that didn't happen when I was 19. I was already married, and my wife at the time was expecting our first child. So the question is, how were we going to fund that upcoming addition to the family? Decided we try to sell some theremin kits, and we were so busy at it that I had to drop out of graduate school at Cornell for 6 months in order to take care of the demand.
And it allowed you to put together enough money to get to work on what sits on the table between us right now, which is a version, a very recent version of the Moog synthesizer.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, I, as my graduate studies came to an end, I began to wonder what I was going to do for a living, and we decided, well, I might as well get it out of my system. We might as well let me try and build kits. I was going to be a kit manufacturer. The first kit was not a big success. It was a battery-powered musical instrument amplifier kit, which I saw a need for, but not many other people did. But in the process of trying and failing at that, I met a musician who asked me if I knew anything about electronic music. This was back in 1963 now. And I'd heard of it. In fact, when I was an electrical engineering student at Columbia, my electronic laboratory professor, Peter Mose, asked me if I knew anything about the Columbia-Princeton Electronic Music Center at the other side of the campus. He said, his words, I think, were, they're doing some interesting things over there. You might want to look in.
Now, but at the time, what you were playing with didn't really look anything like the Moog Voyager, Mini Moog Voyager that we have on the table between us. It was a great, you called them breadboards at one point at that time. Why breadboards?
What an electronic experimenter means by a breadboard is something that is literally has the parts screwed to a piece of wood. it could be a breadboard or something close to it. And that was just a very cheap way of making something simple and letting you get it working.
Now, I have to say that my electronic expertise is such that you could show me the schematics for a cruise missile, tell me that was a synthesizer, and I'd believe you. But I wonder if you can, using your skill as a demonstrator here, touch a key, tell us what's going on in the synthesizer. What moved us beyond the woo-woo of the theremin to what's become a very precise and popular instrument?
Well, the theremin is very simple. It has one tone generator called an oscillator in it, and one means of controlling how strong that tone is, which...
it's like a dimmer switch on a light bulb, right?
Exactly. And both those things respond to hand motion, so how you move your hands is the big thing about the theremin. If you don't move your hands well, you don't get much music at all. What Herb Deutsch, who was a musician I first worked with, was interested in is ways of making electronically brand new sounds that nobody had ever heard before, because he wanted to include these sounds in his tape compositions. So I built one circuit which was called I'll be a little technical now, a voltage-controlled oscillator. An oscillator is something that makes a pure pitch like this. Let's make that just a little bit louder.
Gotcha.
And a voltage-controlled oscillator is an oscillator in which the pitch can be varied by the application of a changing electrical voltage. So I'll play some different notes on the keyboard here. And they sound like different notes to us, but they're actually the same note with different pitches. And I'll illustrate that by playing legato. Still sounds like different notes, but now I'll slow down the rate at which the keyboard voltage can change, and we'll hear that we'll actually be playing one note with a gliding pitch. Turn on the switch first. A little bit slower than that. That's slow, and this is fast. So now we can think about changing the pitch of a sound, not in terms of playing different notes, but of just varying varying a single pitch in what we call real time.
There was something I read about called the attack, decay, sustain, and release envelope, something that you apparently invented with the assistance of a 35-cent doorbell switch.
Those terms, attack, decay, sustain, and release, were actually defined by the head of the Columbia Princeton Electronic Music Center. His name was Vladimir Usachevsky. Good Italian name. What we hear now, shut the glide off here, make the sound a little bit brighter so we can hear it more clearly, is a sound that goes on abruptly and goes off abruptly as I hit the key. But I can slow down at the rate at which it goes off, so we can hear the sound. I'm setting the knobs as I talk here. The loudness now will build up and then decay to a lower level every time I press a key. I can make that very slow or very fast or anything in between. You know, for instance, here's an envelope that's very short. And here's one with a medium attack. The attack is the beginning part. And a full sustain. And an abrupt release. If I wanted to play a fast attack and a gradual release, it would sound more like a piano then. Let's get it right here. Here we go. Now, I don't mean it sounds altogether like a piano, but the way the loudness starts off loud and ends up dying out gradually is piano-like. So,
I wonder if I can get you to set the knobs and dials to just play us a little bit of music. We have to take a break in about a minute's time, and if you could do that, and I'll just have a short chat with Connection listeners. As Bob continues to play, and this is Mr. Moog on the Moog Synthesizer, Connection listeners, I just wanted to let you know our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. If you'd like to join our conversation about the place of the Moog synthesizer in the music that we know today, but taking us out to the break, here is Robert Moog on his synthesizer. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Gordon, this is The Connection, and this is the music of Beck from the Grammy Award-winning album Mutations, playing, among other things, the Moog synthesizer. My guest in the studio today is Bob Moog, inventor of the Moog synthesizer. He's in Boston to receive an honorary degree tonight from the Berklee College of Music. That goes along with his Grammy from earlier this year and many other honors from the music world. Are you familiar with this music as well?
I've heard it once or twice.
I can imagine. Everybody's sending you discs. Look what I can do with my synthesizer. Let's bring Trevor Pinch into the conversation. Trevor's co-author with Frank Trucco of a new book called Analog Days, The Invention and Impact of the Moog Synthesizer. He's joining us from Cornell University, where he's a professor of science and technology studies. Hi, Trevor. How are you?
Fine. Hi, Dick. Hi, Bob. Good to be with you.
Hi, Trevor.
Now, you are the learned academic that I quoted earlier in the program as saying that of the significant musical inventions in the last century, the Moog synthesizer stands alone with the electric guitar. Why does it have that stature?
Well, if you think of how many new musical instruments come into being, inventors are always coming up with new ideas for musical instruments, but there are very few that actually get accepted and routinely used. You can go into a music store and buy them, as you can with the guitar and the synthesizer. The theremin is a wonderful instrument, but you can't go into your local music store and buy a theremin. You can order it online from Bob, I believe.
Still?
So it's, yeah.
Okay.
Well, you can go into some stores and buy them. If the truth
it doesn't have the widespread acceptance of the synthesizer and the electric guitar, I would think.
Yes, sir.
There was a jump, though, Trevor, from the experimental music studios to the stage, to the music stores, to garage bands, to people who actually got their hands on something that they could play. What was it that put it out in the mainstream? What did Bob do?
Well, I think one important thing he did, he listened to his customers. What he did was he brought his customers up to Trumansburg, where that's near Ithaca in the middle of nowhere, where he has
lots of listeners there.
It was a shock for me coming from England to Ithaca to find how isolated it was. The joke is Ithaca is centrally isolated. Where Bob had his factory, Trumansburg is just isolated. It really is in a little place on the lake.
Nothing central about it.
He had his factory there, and he had a studio in his factory. And one of the things he would do is he'd bring people to his studio, and he'd learn how they'd use his synthesizer. And this was very important because he saw how they used the synthesizer, and he adapted the synthesizer to the way they used it. For one of the things that's characteristic of the Moog synthesizer, it's got a keyboard. Now, it wasn't obvious at the time that the keyboard was going to be the main way of interacting with the synthesizer. There was a synthesizer manufacturer, Don Buchler, on the West Coast, who rejected the standard keyboard as the way of interacting with the synthesizer.
So, Bob, was there one piece of advice that you refer back to when you think, you know, it was that musician, it was that request that...
No, I think it's... what I learned is the sum of a lot of... perceptions and ideas. I don't think there's any one.
Trevor, back
I think an important part of this story is that this happened in the 60s, the psychedelic 60s, and the Moog synthesizer, indeed the Buchler synthesizer, were taken up within psychedelia first, before Wendy Carlos came along with Switched on Bach, because people wanted to explore new sounds, new instruments, those new timbres that the Moog offered. I think that's when the Doors first used the synthesizer. I think that's an important part of the story.
Hmm. And were you in conversation with these musicians as people tried to experiment with it in their music, Bob?
I was either in talking to them or talking to people who knew them. One way or another, the ideas got back to us. But Trevor is certainly right. Trumansburg was isolated, and we didn't know firsthand about what was going on until... somebody told us, and people would bring records into the studio and bring reports from what was happening in New York. New York was only a 6-hour bus ride from our front door.
But were you shocked at the sort of explosion of interest in the synthesizer? It was, after all, something that you'd just been noodling at for yourself for some considerable period of time.
The explosion of interest happened as a result of Switched on Bach. Now, I knew that Switched on Bach was an important work on our instrument. I knew that because I'd been listening to what Carlos and her associates were doing years before. You know, Switched on Bach didn't come fully shaped out of nowhere. Carlos already was an experienced electronic music composer, having learned at Columbia Princeton Electronic Music Center. and did a lot of experimentation with multi-track recorders and our synthesizer before Switched on Bach came out. I had the honor and the pleasure of introducing Switched on Bach to a group of recording music engineers before the record was actually released. And I can remember distinctly that these recording engineers were so overwhelmed at the quality and the musicality of this that they gave Carlos a standing ovation.
And put in a few orders with you for the same sort of instrument.
I mean, yeah.
Trevor, you need to fess up with us here because you're also a musician whose first exposure to the synthesizer was as someone who wanted to play it rather than write about it.
That's absolutely right. Back in the early 70s, I was a student at London. I was a student of physics. And as a kid, rather like Bob, I indulged in breadboards. I built myself little radio sets, amateur radio I was interested in. And I was part of a psychedelic band, and we wanted to synthesize, and we couldn't afford it. In those days, synthesizers cost an awful lot of money. And being a kind of starving student, I thought, well, I'll build my own synthesizer. So I got some schematics from a hobbyist magazine, Wireless World, and built my own synthesizer. And that was my very first interest in the synthesizer. And of course, I knew of the Moog synthesizer, and I sort of looked at it in music stores in London with envy. I couldn't afford such a machine. And so when I came to work at Cornell University as a professor there and discovered the Moog synthesizer had been invented in Trumansburg right near Ithaca, it was sort of a moment of epiphany for me. I thought, wow, this is amazing, this tiny place. Somebody's got to write the story of this invention, this fabulous invention that affected so much music.
We're joined now by a man who still might be destroying Hammond organs if it weren't for the invention of the Moog synthesizer. Keith Emerson of the legendary progressive rock band Emerson, Lake & Palmer joins us from his home in California, where he's busy packing for a European tour with his old band, The Nice. Action listeners, how about that? Lucky man. Now, Keith, you and Bob Moog go way back. Is that right?
Way, way back. Good morning, by the way. I'm just waking up here.
Uh-oh.
I did say we're in California.
It's Bob here.
God, I haven't seen this time in the morning in years. Unbelievable. Oh, but it's just about daylight out there. There you go. Yeah, I've known Bob a long time. Yes, good. Go back to 1969.
And that solo, Lucky Man, was apparently something of an accident.
Yes, it was. There was a repetitive refrain on the guitar going over and over again. And I said, well, we can't leave it like that. You know, stick something on the end. And I don't think my actual Moog had arrived at that time. But there was a modular version in the back of the studio, so we wired it up, got some sort of a sound out of it, and I thought, well, this is great fun. I'd actually borrowed one before from a guy that worked with Manfred Mann, and I'd used it in concert with the London Philharmonic Orchestra. And it proved such a great success in live performance. But anyway...
That was you in a silver spacesuit at the time, wasn't it?
Well, we were doing music from 2001 at the time, so I thought, well, that would work, you know, you might as well get the gear to go with it, you see. But anyway, we wired it up, and I played a solo over this thing called Lucky Man, and... I thought it was, you know, show possibilities, but everybody in the control room was going absolutely nuts. I said, that's the one. I said, oh, no, come on, let me have another go. And they said, no, that's the one. We don't have any more tracks left for you to experiment anymore.
Tape was expensive.
Yeah, that's right. So that was it. I said, oh, great, you know. And there we go.
Keep that... The Moog that I remember reading about on the album jacket of yours was the Monster Moog, the sort of theatrical great wall of sound you'd build around yourself for Emerson, Lake and Palmer. Was that was the theater a large part of the performance?
Yes. You see, you're very pedestrian, I suppose. I don't know if it's the right word. But you're very static playing a piano, and I think it doesn't matter how good the player is, that it becomes a little bit boring to look at a keyboard player after a while. And, plus the fact that guitarists were managing to pull all the chicks, I decided to get a bit more mobile. So, and that's really what happened with the Hammond organ. I started lugging that around the stage. for a little guy like me, 350-pound organ is quite a lot to lug around and make it look like it's part of your body, you know?
Well, going back, Bob Moog, to the part of the conversation where Trevor was saying that you would listen to the musicians, this led in part to the creation of what was called the ribbon controller, the almost guitar-like looking way of playing a synthesizer, which, of course, was such a part of Emerson, Lake, and Palmer.
Yes, well, it was a very very phallic instrument, the way you had to sort of rub it up and down to make noises, you know. And, I sort of stuck fireworks on the end of it and nitroglycerin balls of flame would shoot out the end of it. It was great fun, absolutely great fun. And, of course, as you said, you know, the theatrics of playing the instrument was a great fun for the audience because they could actually see you making changes and they could hear the sound changing as you played, as you took a jack plug out and put it somewhere else or put a switch there.
Bob Moog, was this part of the intention?
Well, that's the point for me. We didn't have much intention of anything. We developed the ribbon controller to think, well, we can vary a parameter. You know, that's a technical way of looking at what the ribbon controller can do. Keith had the insight to instantly know how to make these incredibly theatrical and musical gestures with them. He just drove people nuts with what he was doing, and it seemed to come natural to him. But it's a very special gift that a musician has, that when presented with a new tool like this, instantly he knows something to do with it that's exciting.
And so is it a gift to be woken out of a dead sleep while you're packing for a trip and still be able to tell a good story? Keith, I'm going to let you go back under the covers.
Well, no, don't worry, but there's one more thing. But thank you for saying that, Bob. That's very sweet of you. In May this year, I was asked to play solo piano at one of the Golden Jubilee festivals in England. And I was presented to Her Majesty the Queen and His Royal Highness the Duke of Edinburgh. And the Duke of Edinburgh came up to me and he said, do you bang or do you scrape? So, I mean, you know, well, I should have replied that I bang. Well, I bang the Moog when it doesn't work and I scrape a living when it does, you know. But, the guy obviously had no concept about Dr. Robert Moog's pioneering invention at all. I think if you spoke to the Queen or the Duke of Edinburgh about horses, they'd know a lot more about that, you know. But there we go.
Thanks for being with us, Keith.
Well, thank you for talking. and Trevor's there, right, as well.
He's somewhere.
Hi, Keith.
Yeah. Hi, Trevor.
Hi,
all right,
Keith,
guys, have fun. I'm going to go back to sleep. Good morning.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We're going to Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Alex is joining us on the line. Hi, Alex.
Hi, how are you doing, Dick?
Fine, thanks.
And hello, Bob.
Hi, Alex.
I was just calling to share my earliest Moog memory. When I was 5 years old, I was watching American Bandstand, and the Captain and Tennille were on. I didn't really care for him much then. I still don't care for him much now.
All right.
But during the solo of Muskrat Love, I saw what I assume was a mini Moog and instantly sat down and built one out of Legos. and have been fascinated by them ever since. I've bought and sold analog synths the better part of my life, and after years of just experimenting on them and doing sound patches, I've finally started taking piano lessons at the age of 33. So I've kind of gone backwards from making weird and odd noises to, you know, learning how to play Firefly and Jack and the Beanstalk and such, you know, simple songs like that where I'm actually learning how to play them correctly. But I wanted to just call and say that I think, you know, the synthesizer has been, you know, is on par with the electric guitar. As with anything, some good music and some really bad music has come out of synthesizers, but Bob himself, I think, is, well, I think he kind of represents everything that's good about the music industry, because I think he got into it for all the right reasons. And that's basically my comments. I've had the pleasure of meeting him a couple of times and found that his wife and family were excellent people, so if you can judge him by the company he keeps, that kind of backs up what I'm saying.
There you go.
Yeah.
Thanks, Alex.
Thanks, Alex.
Yeah, take care, Bob. Bye.
A little bit of Radiohead in the background, something from the album Kid A, a little more of where the Moog synthesizer is today. Do you ever get tired of listening to what people do with this instrument?
Well, sometimes. I get tired of what some people do with it, but, you know, that's... I usually don't get tired of it.
Bob Moog in the studio with me. Trevor Pinch in the studio nearby, author of Analog Days, The Invention and Impact of the Moog Synthesizer. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, join our conversation with the inventor of the Moog Synthesizer.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection, and you're listening to Steppenwolf's Born to be Wild by the Moog Cookbook. I just have a little bit of trouble seeing Peter Fonda on his Harley listening to that. My guest today is Bob Moog, the man who invented the Moog synthesizer. And Bob, we're talking about what is happening now with the synthesizer. You've brought something very new, something that was given to you, I believe, last night in Springfield, Massachusetts, by two young musicians named Timothy and Eric Natto. Can we listen to a little bit of that now? Let's hear it. Now, you had this in your, CD player on your way in?
Yeah, my car at home is so old that it barely has a cassette player in it. But this was a rental car that had a CD player in it. Wow, what great driving along and listening to CDs.
What they've produced here, they've produced with an old-style Moog synthesizer or something that's more digital. Can you tell by listening?
I really can't because every sound on this has been highly processed and sequenced. Certainly they used something like a computer program to put this all together with.
Right.
There's no reason that it couldn't have been made on a lot of these sounds couldn't have been made on
just using the same instrument that you've got on the table in front of you now.
It certainly could be made with that.
Let me ask Trevor, just a last question for you, Trevor. Analog Days is the title of the book that you wrote about the invention and the impact of the Moog synthesizer. But so many people know so much about synthetic sounds now that are digital. Why did you make the distinction?
Because in those early days, the technology was analog in the sense of continuous variables. And our book is about the early period up to about 1975 when the technology was analog. I think the interesting thing today is this kind of analog revival on. So although you've got digital instruments, people are still buying those old analog Moog synthesizers because there's something very special about that sound, the analog sound that people want. And so we thought we'd call our book Analog Days to represent what the period was like back then and the new interest.
Can you, as a musician, hear the difference between the analog and the digital? Or, I mean, do you know what those people who are after the old things are looking for?
I find it very hard to tell the difference listening, but I think I understand what the musicians are after.
That's exactly the point.
Go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, that's exactly the point. You can feel the difference when you play an analog instrument, and that affects how your musical ideas come out.
Yeah, it's the interface that they love, the knobs and wires, and with digital menus, it's not the same. And there's some very good emulations of old Moog synthesizers on the internet where you're basically clicking, and you're clicking away and putting the wires in for a double click, and that isn't the same as turning a knob. A knob is a musical instrument in its own right, in effect. You know, you're interacting with this thing.
We're going to try and get to some of our callers, so Trevor, I'll take this chance to say thanks a lot for being part of our program.
Thank you very much indeed.
Trevor Pinch is co-author of Analog Days, The Invention and Impact of a Moog Synthesizer. In Boston now, Sean's waiting on the line. Hi, Sean.
How are you? I'm so glad that this subject was brought up about analog, because that's exactly what I've been waiting to talk about. I'm so thrilled to see the resurgence of interest in analog synthesizers, because I think people can hear the difference. Maybe not everybody, but I know that when I was listening to the beginning of your show, when Bob was noodling around on the keyboard, I was amazed by how rich and warm that sound was coming over the radio. And I thought, maybe they've just got a mic stuck in an amplifier there or something. But the point is, I'm getting this sound through good old analog diffusion technology, and I can hear the difference. When I listened to the Moog, I just heard the CD of When DeCarlos Is Switched On Bach and compared it to my turntable version of it, and I just so prefer the sound of the original analog recording. I wonder, even though some people say they can't hear the difference, if it isn't because there are people who can hear the difference that so many of these old 30-year-old machines are being sold on eBay for, you know, huge prices. I mean, people are really chasing these things down. And
you didn't store any in your basement, did you, Bob? You're not parceling them out one at a time?
No, I like to get things in the hands of musicians. I don't like to keep things around.
But you're still in the business now.
Yeah,
your new company, what is it, Big Briar?
Well, Big Briar has just changed its name very recently to Moog Music Incorporated.
Back to Moog Music.
We have
rights to your name again.
That's right. We own the registration of the Moog Music trademark.
And the instrument in front of you is the Voyager version,
right,
of the Mini Moog. Is that right?
That's exactly right.
And does it embrace some of what Sean's talking about, the richness of the sound that was in the original machinery?
Yes, all the sound capability in this new Voyager is analog. So it can do everything sound-wise that an original classic Mini Moog can do, but it can do much more because there are more functions now, but they're all analog.
Give us a little bit of that richness.
A little bit? Let's see, what can we do here? Let's turn on another oscillator here.
Welcome to the connection zone.
There.
I love it. Sean, thanks for your call. To Boston. And, where am I going? I'm going to Woburn, Massachusetts, and Joan's waiting on the line. Hi, Joan.
Hi, Dick. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Joan.
Are you the Bob Moog who built and demonstrated a theremin on the stage of the Bronx High School of Science Auditorium in the 50s?
Good Lord, I've been found out.
You have, I'm sorry. I remember riding on the subway with you and talking about these things, although my own interests diverged into physics R&D. I have kept an ear out as a musician. I kept an ear out, and I was actually going to ask about the analog-digital argument. And I guess the answer, I've gotten the answer both from you and from some of the other guests.
I wonder if you can do something for me, Joan. I want you to take me back to the experience of hearing that music in the 1950s, because, you know, there's a part of it that's become so over-kitched where you can open up a birthday card and a little thing goes, and yet, you know, there is... I wonder if we haven't lost that sense of amazement of what it was the synthesizer was creating in the 50s.
I think that's true because, as someone else has said, the recordings, the performances even, are so controlled. They're sequenced, they're overdubbed, and I think it's probably true that we don't get the same effect that we got, 40 years ago? For me, as a classical musician, the sound of the theremin was really way out, but I had to appreciate the fact that there it was in a plywood case that Bob had put together. And as I recall, there was a little bit of smoke that came out of it at the end.
Is that true, Bob?
I don't remember anything like that.
You can't remember. Anyway, congratulations on your honorary degree.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
I need to see, Bob, if you can take me back as well to what it was that drew you to the newness of the sound at the time when you were creating it, how you'd plug in a new envelope and go, oh.
I'm not sure that I got excited until I heard a musician actually doing something with it.
You're very modest about this, you know.
Well, I think that's the truth. The monkey on my back doesn't make me compose. It makes me design circuits. So I see what something is good for when I turn what I've done over to a musician, and the monkey on their back tells them what to do.
We have another one of those musicians on the line from Boylston, Massachusetts. Jay's joining us. Hi, Jay.
Hi, how you doing, Bob?
Hi, Jay.
I actually got to meet you in 1991 at the NAMM show, and I walked up to you, I recognized your face, and I shook your hand, and you kind of looked at me like, why, you know, almost like you were beside yourself, you know, why do I even deserve this kind of honor kind of thing? It was a humbling experience to see you so humble at that experience. And, you know, I have to say, I fell in love with the sound of electronic music when I was really little. I mean, I've always been into science fiction movies and loved the sound of the old theremins and even in saws. You know, people play saws. It's kind of the same sound. And, you know, I own a Moog Source. I've had it since it came out. Mm-hmm. And it's a great machine. There's a hybrid for you. I mean, it's half analog, half digital. It's got analog oscillators that you have to wait about an hour for, like, to warm up. Otherwise, they keep drifting out of tune. But once it's warmed up, it's great. And it uses digital control to manipulate the oscillators. Mm-hmm. And, you know, someone was talking before about having all the knobs. It only has one knob. So you can only adjust one parameter at a time if you want to actually alter the sound while you're playing.
But you never really run out of things to do, though. That's the cool thing about the instrument, isn't it, Jay?
They're totally limitless. I also have an FM synthesizer, which uses an entirely different method of producing sounds. And a lot of people are really intimidated with FM synthesis because the programming is so foreign. It's all mathematical. It's you're basically adding different sine waves together to produce square waves or approximate square waves. So it doesn't have the real fat, sweet sound that the analogs have, but it produces wonderful bells. It sounds, you know, the FM synthesizers actually sound better than like a Fender Rhodes.
Jay, I want to thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Nice to have you on the program. How do you account, Bob Moog, for the fact that there was this kind of split that happened in the use of electronic music, that some of it went to the lowest form of sort of grade B kitsch, and you know, Jay was talking about science fiction movies, and some of it went really highbrow?
I think it started out highbrow, that the experimenters with the electronic music medium throughout the 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s were academic people. They were intellectuals you know, they didn't care particularly at all about commercial success. And what they did gave people who make commercial music or make pop music for a living, you know, gave them ideas. And it takes a while for people to understand what a new resource, how it can be used. People like Keith Emerson can discover it in 10 seconds, but for most of us, it takes years.
You're still at it. Mm-hmm. There's a pedal on the floor behind you called the Moger Foger?
Yeah.
What does the Moger Foger do? Is this isn't brand new, but it's one of your more recent inventions, right?
A Moger Foger is a piece of an analog synthesizer, along with all the control capability. So, you know, whereas most things on the floor that a musician uses are effects boxes, and you turn them on, turn them off, the Moger Foger you can play by plugging expression pedals into it, or you can play by bringing it up as I have here near to where my hands are and play the knobs as the sound is going through it. I have one connected up to the theremin. I can make a theremin sound. And I'll bring in the Moger Foger here with the foot pedal. There's a foot pedal.
You must have one of the most fun jobs around.
Well, over the years, I've gotten some facility to have fun with all these knobs. So I can begin to enjoy just making great sounds, but I can also enjoy working with musicians. That's a more substantial.
And you're
point.
Getting the honor you deserve with the honorary degree from Berkeley. Once again, congratulations for that.
Yeah, I really love Berkeley. I've been there a few times now, giving talks and meeting the students. There's such a great bunch of students, and the musician instructors that are there are absolutely top-level creative people. It's just a great place.
I have to read a couple of credits just to close the program down. I wonder if I can get you to play some music while I'm doing that.
Ah, you want me to play? Oh.
Bob Moog, inventor of the Moog synthesizer, my guest today. Tonight, as I mentioned, that honorary doctorate from the Berklee College of Music here in Boston. We spoke earlier on the program with Trevor Pinch, co-author of the new book Analog Days, and Keith Emerson, who deigned to wake up for us, of the rock and roll band Emerson, Lake and Palmer. Connection listeners, you can continue the conversation online at theconnection.org. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to